Imagine for a second that you are standing in the middle of a massive, like, 1,000-acre field right in the middle of the Midwest.
Oh, wow. Okay. Setting the scene.
Right. The sun is beating down. You just spent millions of dollars on, seed, fertilizer, diesel fuel for all your tractors. Your entire livelihood, like your whole net worth and your ability to feed your family, is currently just sitting out there in the dirt.
Completely exposed.
Exactly. Entirely at the mercy of the weather. But, and here's the crazy part, it's not just the local weather you have to worry about.
Right, it's global.
Yeah. What if it rains, like perfectly in Brazil, and they get this record crop down in South America? Suddenly, the global price of your crop just completely collapses before you can even harvest.
You lose everything.
Everything. In like 3 days, your entire year's income could just evaporate, and you wouldn't have done a single thing wrong.
Which is honestly a terrifying reality for global commodity producers.
It's a nightmare. But today, we're going to learn the mathematical cheat code that makes them financially bulletproof.
I love that framing. Bulletproof.
But hey, before we get into the weeds, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They've got a full Series 3 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at certfuel.com.
Honestly, those practice exams are lifesavers for this specific topic.
Oh, totally. Which brings us to our mission today. If you are listening to this right now, you are likely staring down the barrel of this Series 3 exam. You're trying to get licensed.
And today we are mastering one of the absolute most important subjects on that test, which is hedging
Yeah,
calculations.
and we really can't overstate how critical this is, right?
No, not at all. This isn't just some like obscure niche topic that might pop up once. This material represents a massive chunk of the test. When you combine chapters 1 through 7, part one spans roughly 71% of the entire exam.
71%.
Yeah, you simply cannot fake your way through this. You have to know it cold.
But, like, here's the thing. Our goal today is not to just hand you a list of formulas to memorize. We are not just going to read a textbook at you.
Right, because if you just memorize a formula to regurgitate it, you're going to immediately forget it the second you sit down.
Exactly. If you're like me, ADHD, distracted, easily rote memorization just straight up fails under pressure. The fluorescent lights are humming in the testing center, exam fatigue sets in, and you're staring at this massive word problem.
And your mind just goes blank.
Totally blank. So we want you to deeply, intuitively understand the why behind these numbers, because understanding the underlying mechanics is what allows you to actually recall it.
I completely agree. If you understand the physical reality of what these hedgers are actually trying to do, the math just becomes common sense. It's not an abstract formula anymore.
Right. So to keep our brains locked in today, and to keep this from turning into a dry, boring math lecture, we are going to use two recurring characters to anchor every single scenario.
This is crucial. Having a mental image really helps.
Yeah, I want you to literally picture these two people in your head. First, we have Soybean Sally.
Ah, Soybean Sally.
A legend.
A total legend. She is a stressed out crop producer in Iowa. She is our seller. I want you to picture her like driving around her farm in a dusty pickup truck.
Dog in the passenger seat.
Yes, golden retriever in the passenger seat. And she is constantly checking the weather app on her phone. She's naturally long the physical cash commodity because she has thousands of acres of soybeans just growing in the dirt.
And her ultimate nightmare, her constant agonizing fear, is that global commodity prices are going to just drop out from under her before she can sell,
Exactly.
which is a very real existential fear. You know, if she spends $10 a bushel to grow the beans and the market crashes to $8 by harvest time,
She's ruined.
yeah, she takes a massive catastrophic loss. Falling prices are her absolute worst enemy.
So that's Sally. But on the complete opposite side of the universe, we have our second character, Cornflakes Carl.
The ultimate buyer. The ultimate buyer. Carl is this frantic, perpetually sweating factory manager at a massive cereal plant in Chicago. Like, you can literally smell the toasted corn when you walk into his office.
I'm picturing him drinking way too much coffee.
Way too much.
Yeah.
He wakes up in cold sweats, terrified that the price of raw grain is going to absolutely skyrocket before he can secure enough inventory for his factory.
Because the CEO is constantly yelling at him about profit margins, right?
Right.
Because Carl is naturally short the physical commodity. He desperately needs thousands of tons of corn to make his cereal, but he doesn't own it yet. He has to go buy it.
And if the price of corn, like, triples because of a drought.
His production costs explode, the profit margins are destroyed, he might even have to shut down the factory.
So rising prices are his worst nightmare.
Exactly.
Okay, so we have Soybean Sally, terrified of falling prices, and Cornflakes Carl, terrified of rising prices. Today is all about taking the idea of basis and turning it into actual hard numbers that save these two from bankruptcy.
And what I love about this is that despite how intentionally complicated the exam writers make these word problems seem, every single calculation today collapses into one beautifully simple line of math.
One beautiful simple line of math. I love it. But before we hand over the cheat code, we have to understand the mechanics.
Right, the why.
Yeah, break this down for me. What does it actually mean to be fully hedged in the real world?
So to understand the math, you first have to visualize the mechanics. A hedger, whether it's Sally or Carl, always holds two completely separate positions at the exact same time.
Okay, always two.
Always two. This is what we call the two market add-up. You have your cash position and you have your futures position.
But let's slow down and define those. What exactly is the cash position?
The cash position is physical reality. It's the actual stuff in the real world. For Sally, her cash position is the literal soybeans growing in her dirt in Iowa.
Got it.
For Carl, his cash position is the physical train cars full of corn that he has to unload at his factory. The cash market is where you buy or sell physical stuff.
That makes total sense. And the second position?
The second position is the offsetting futures position. This is the financial contract traded on an exchange in Chicago or New York. It is purely a paper asset.
So it's completely separate from the local grain elevator.
Entirely separate. So when the exam asks you to calculate the net result of a hedge, you have to remember that it's simply the cash market result plus the futures market result.
You're literally taking the financial outcome of the physical world and adding it to the outcome of the paper world.
Exactly.
Okay, I want to use an analogy here because I think it makes this abstract concept incredibly visual. It's a little absurd, but stick with me.
I love absurd. Let's hear it.
I want you to imagine Soybean Sally walking around her farm, but strapped to her back, like bolted onto this massive pulley system, is this giant, heavy iron counterweight.
Okay, a giant counterweight.
Yeah, and this counterweight represents her futures position. It represents that paper contract in Chicago. Now, Sally's physical cash crop is sitting on one side of a scale, and the counterweight is on the other. When the value of her physical crop sags, let's say global supply gluts the market and prices drop into a deep hole, that giant iron counterweight on the pulley system rises up into the air by roughly the exact same amount.
That is a perfect visualization. The futures leg is literally engineered to be a counterweight to reality.
And it works the other way too. If there's a sudden shortage and the cash price of her physical beans jumps up into the sky, the counterweight drops down into the hole. Mm. They are mathematically linked to move in opposite directions.
Exactly.
So I have a direct question for you listening right now. Pause whatever you are doing and think about this. If you are Soybean Sally, are you trying to make a massive speculative profit on that iron counterweight? I'll give you a beat to think about it.
Trick a second?
No, absolutely not. Yeah. You are not trying to get rich off the counterweight. You are just trying to keep the whole machine from tipping over and crushing you.
That right there is the crucial shift in mindset you need for this exam. People get confused because they think of futures trading as a way to gamble and make huge profits.
Like day trading on Wall Street.
Right. But a hedger does not aim to make money on the futures leg. The goal is purely to lock in a price and survive. A financial loss on one leg is specifically designed to be paid for by a financial gain on the other.
It's a survival tool.
Yes. But how does the math actually work? How does that counterweight generate gains and losses?
It depends entirely on which side of the market you're on. Let's look at Sally first. She is a short hedger.
Why short?
Because she initiates her hedge by selling futures contracts first. She is naturally long the physical beans. So to create the opposite counterweight, she goes short in the futures market.
Okay, so she sells first.
Right. And for any short position, how do you calculate profit? It's the initial price you sold it for minus the price you eventually buy it back for. Sell high, buy low.
The classic short squeeze logic, but applied to farming.
Exactly. Let's put numbers to it. If Sally calls her broker in April and sells a futures contract at 440 cents a bushel, and by harvest time in October, the market has dropped to 420 cents.
Okay, 440 down to 420. She buys that contract back at 420 to close it out. She originally sold it for 440. She just bought it back for 420. She made 20 cents a bushel in profit.
Her counterweight just rose by 20 cents.
Yes, That 20 cents is pure financial profit sitting in her brokerage account. Now look at the complete opposite scenario, Cornflakes Carl. He is a long hedger.
Because he initiates by buying futures first.
Correct. Yeah. He's naturally short the physical corn, so he goes long in the paper market. For a long position, profit is calculated the traditional way, sell price minus buy price, buy low, sell high.
Okay, let's run Carl's numbers. He's terrified of prices going up. So he buys corn futures at 440 cents to lock in his cost. A massive drought hits. The market skyrockets to 465 cents.
Right.
Carl calls his broker and sells those futures back at 465 to close the position. He bought at 440, sold at 455. He made 25 cents a bushel.
His counterweight just caught the rising price and generated 25 cents of profit. In both cases, the counterweight catches the movement of the market and spits out cash to protect them.
But this brings us to a massive foundational trap that the exam writers will definitely use to trick you.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, if you're listening, this is where the exam tries to get you.
Yeah.
Listen very closely. Because this is how they steal points from smart people.
The trap is this. The exam will give you a long, complicated paragraph about a farmer or a factory. You will calculate the futures gain or loss. Let's say you figure out Sally made 20 cents on her futures trade.
Yeah, you do the math, you feel good about it.
You look down at the multiple choice answers, and answer A will boldly say 20 cent gain. They are trying to trick you into reporting only the futures gain and calling it the net outcome of the hedge.
It's so tempting. The number is right there on the screen. You want to click it and move on.
Do not fall for it. A hedge's net result is always the sum of both legs. It is never the futures leg alone. If you just report the futures gain, you are completely ignoring the physical cash commodity.
You're literally looking at the iron counterweight and completely ignoring soybean Sally and her thousands of acres of beans.
Exactly. You always have to combine the cash market result with the futures market result.
So if the question asks for the net result, and one of the answers is just the bare profit from the futures account, cross it out immediately. It is 100% bait.
It is bait. And that leads directly to a second deeply psychological exam trap that really messes with people's heads.
Ooh, what's that?
Let's say you're working through a problem, you calculate the futures leg, and it shows a massive financial loss. Human nature makes us look at a losing trade, panic, and think, oh no, the hedge failed. I must have set up the math wrong.
Right. Nobody likes seeing red numbers in their account. We're conditioned to think a loss means failure.
But in the context of a hedge, a losing futures position is completely, perfectly normal. It is not a failed hedge.
Think about the pulley system again.
Exactly. If the cash side of your business suddenly gains tremendous value, let's say Sally's physical beans double in price, the futures leg, the counterweight, is supposed to plunge into the dirt and show a loss.
They cancel each other out by design.
Yes. Let me make sure you're totally wrapping your head around this. If Sally shorts futures at 440, but then an unprecedented global shortage happens, and physical beans are suddenly selling for 800 cents a bushel.
Wow.
Her physical cash crop just became incredibly life-changingly valuable. She is going to make a fortune at the local elevator.
But her short futures position, the one she sold at 440, is getting absolutely obliterated. She's bleeding money in her margin account.
But she doesn't care. She doesn't care that her futures account is in the red because she is making so much money selling the actual physical beans that it completely covers the loss.
The hedge did exactly what it was supposed to do. It removed the volatility and locked her in at her original expected price.
Exactly. You have to divorce yourself from the idea that a futures loss is a bad thing when you are a hedger. Never grade a hedge on the futures leg alone.
Okay, I think I've got the counterweight concept down. I understand the mechanics of the two markets. I add the physical cash result to the paper futures result. But honestly, as someone with ADHD, the idea of having to calculate two completely different markets every single time, finding the difference in the cash market, finding the difference in the futures market, figuring out long versus short, and then adding them all together.
It's a lot.
It sounds exhausting to do 50 times in a row on a timed exam. There has to be a faster way. Is there a cheat code?
There is. And it is arguably the single most important formula in this entire deep dive. It is the master key that ties every single hedging calculation together.
Okay, lay it on me. What is the ultimate shortcut?
Net price equals the initial futures price plus the ending basis.
I'm going to repeat that slowly because it is that important. Net price equals initial futures price plus ending basis.
That is it. That one single elegant formula works for both Soybean Sally, the seller, and Cornflakes Carl, the buyer. You do not need two separate complicated procedures.
You don't need a seller's formula and a buyer's formula.
Nope. You just need to know the initial futures price, and you need to know the ending basis.
Okay, I love a shortcut, but my brain won't let me just memorize it without understanding why it works. I need the logic. Why does this simple addition problem replace all that complicated two-market math?
Let's break it down conceptually. Think of the futures leg of the hedge as locking in the big number. That is your anchor.
The anchor. Okay.
When Soybean Sally calls her broker in April and sells futures at 440, she is effectively locking her financial destiny into that 440 neighborhood. She is eliminating the huge, scary global price swings.
Right, because if the global market crashes by $3, her counterweight gives her $3 back, keeping her anchored at 440.
Exactly. Uh-huh. So the initial futures price is the anchor. But it's not the exact final price because the futures market in Chicago is not identical to the physical market at the grain elevator in Iowa. There is a slight gap between the two.
And what do we call that gap?
Basis. Cash price minus futures price equals basis.
Right. So the basis is just a tiny localized adjustment that gets stapled onto your anchor at the very end.
Yes. The futures market gives you the big number, and the local basis gives you the final fine-tuning adjustment.
So the initial futures action takes care of the massive existential dread. It anchors you against global catastrophes. And the basis is just the small local reality check at the exact moment you actually sell the physical bean.
Precisely. Whatever the local basis happens to be at the exact moment the hedge is lifted, that is exactly what gets added to that locked in initial futures price to give you your true net price.
Okay, I want to pause the explanation for a second because we really need to talk about that local reality check. You keep saying basis, and I know the formula is cash minus futures. But for someone trying to intuitively grasp this, what actually is basis in the physical world?
That is a fantastic question.
Like, why is there a difference between the Chicago price and the Iowa price in the first place?
Understanding this is the key to mastering this topic.
Yeah.
Basis is the physical reality of the commodity. Think about it this way. A futures contract is an abstract, perfect paper promise. But you can't eat a paper promise. You can't feed it into a cereal factory. You need physical grain. And physical grain is heavy. It takes up space.
It's real stuff.
Yeah. It costs money to store in giant steel silos. It costs money to load onto trains or put onto barges down the Mississippi River. Basis represents all of those physical frictions. Time, space, transportation, local weather, local supply and demand.
So if there's like a massive shortage of train cars in Sally's County in Iowa, she can't physically move her beans to the processor. The local elevator is overflowing.
Exactly.
So the local cash price drops. Even if the global Chicago price is perfectly stable, that transportation bottleneck is the basis widening.
Exactly. Basis is the cost of geography and logistics.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. Now, let's look back at our master formula. Initial futures price plus ending basis. I need everyone listening to snap to attention right now.
Hold up. Shake out your arms, pattern interrupt.
Yes. Listen incredibly closely to the specific wording the expert just used. The formula uses the ending basis, not the starting basis, not the expected basis, the ending basis.
Yes. This is a very common place for candidates to lose easy points.
This is where the exam tries to get you. They will write this massive 6-sentence paragraph setting up the scenario. And the very first sentence will say something like, in April, a farmer plants corn and expects a starting basis of 10 under.
They are deliberately handing you a shiny object to distract you.
So, direct question to you listening right now. If the exam question hands you an expected starting basis of 10 under at the top of the paragraph, and then way down at the bottom reveals an actual ending basis of 5 under when the hedge is lifted, which one goes into our master formula? I'll give you a second.
Think about it.
You use the ending basis, the 5 under. The starting basis is completely irrelevant to the final math. If you yelled ending basis at your dog while walking just now, you nailed it.
You absolutely have to anchor the calculation to the ending basis. Why? Because the final net result of the entire operation is locked in when the hedge is lifted, not when it's placed.
The reality of the local market on the day you actually sell the physical grain is all that matters.
Right. And if you think about the master formula, deeply initial futures plus ending basis, it reveals a really profound philosophical truth about what hedging actually is.
I love a good philosophical truth. What do you mean?
Well, because the net price you mathematically lock in is exactly equal to the initial futures price plus whatever that ending basis turns out to be. Hedging is essentially the act of trading massive flat price risk for tiny basis risk.
Okay, let's define our terms. Clarify flat price risk for me.
Flat price risk is the terrifying existential dread we talked about at the beginning. It is the risk that global corn prices plummet by $2 a bushel because of a geopolitical event or tariffs or perfect weather in Brazil.
It's the big, unpredictable, terrifying swing of the absolute price, the kind of swing that bankrupts a family farm that's been around for four generations.
Exactly. When you put a hedge on, when you lock in that initial futures price, you entirely eliminate that flat price risk. You are completely insulated from the global collapse. The only thing left uncertain, the only floating variable remaining in your final mathematical reality, is exactly where that tiny local ending basis will land on the day you lift the hedge.
And basis risk is comparatively small. Like you said, it's driven by local things like train cars, storage costs, microweather. So Soybean Sally is happily trading the absolute terror of losing $2 a bushel globally for the minor annoying risk of maybe losing 5 or 10 cents locally because the county elevator is a little full.
Exactly. You neutralize the terrifying global market and you choose to take on the manageable local market. That is the essence of hedging.
Okay. I absolutely love the theory. It makes total logical sense. But we need to prove that this master formula actually works in the wild. We need to run the numbers. Let's put Soybean Sally through the ringer. Let's do the producer math from start to finish.
Let's do it. Let's set up the exact scenario. It is springtime. Soybean Sally expects to harvest and sell her physical cash grain later this year, in October. She is terrified of a global price drop. To protect herself, she initiates a short hedge. She calls her broker today and sells futures contracts at exactly 440 cents a bushel.
Okay, so her initial futures price is 440. She has thrown her anchor overboard. She is locked in.
Correct. Now months pass, the summer happens, the harvest comes in, and Sally's absolute worst nightmare comes true. There is a massive global glut of soybeans. The local physical cash price at her grain elevator in Iowa has plummeted all the way down to 410 cents a bushel.
Ouch, 410 is brutal.
And the global futures market in Chicago has also fallen in tandem, dropping to 420 cents a bushel.
Okay, let's look at the physical and financial action she has to take to close this out. She has to lift both legs of the hedge. First, the real world. She loads her trucks, drives to her local physical elevator, and sells her physical cash grain for a miserable 410 cents a bushel. Second, the paper world. She calls her broker and buys back her futures position at 420 to close the hedge.
Let's work the math using the traditional alternative working form first, the long way. The two market add up. In the cash market, Sally receives 410 cents. That is the physical check handed to her by the guy at the elevator. That is money in her pocket.
Right, but 410 is a terrible price. She was hoping for 440. She's hurting. But wait, let's check her iron counterweight. Let's check her futures leg.
Go for it.
She originally sold futures initially at 440. She just called her broker and bought them back at 420. Sell high, buy low. 440 minus 420 is a financial gain of 20 cents per bushel.
Correct. So she has a physical check for 410 from the elevator and a 20 cent financial gain sitting in her futures account. Now, the strict rule for the alternative working form is this. A seller adds a futures gain to their cash sale.
Why? I know you just said it's a rule, but let's explain the logic. Why am I adding a paper gain to my physical sale?
Because that futures gain is a literal extra money coming into your bank account that supports and supplements your terrible physical cash price. The whole point of the counterweight was to spit out cash to save you.
Right. I take the 410 physical cents and I take the 20 cents from my broker and I put them both in my wallet. They combine. So net result equals 410 cash plus 20 futures gain. Her effective net selling price is 430 cents per bushel.
Exactly, 430. The hedge worked beautifully. Mm-hmm. The local physical market completely crashed to 410, which would have ruined her, but because of her counterweight, she effectively walked away with 430 per bushel.
Okay, so that took a few steps. Yeah. Pay to calculate the futures gain, remember the rule to add it, and combine it with the cash. Now, I'm going to jump in here and prove that our shortcut, the master formula, is infinitely better and gets us to the exact same place.
Run the formula. Let's see it.
The formula is initial futures price plus ending basis. Step one, I need to find the ending basis. Basis is always, always, always defined as cash minus futures. At the exact time she lifted the hedge in October, the cash price was 410 and the futures price was 420. So 410 minus 420 is negative 10.
Right. The ending basis is negative 10, or what traders call 10 under.
Step two, I plug it into the master formula. Initial futures was 440. Ending basis was negative 10. 440 plus a negative 10 is 430. It matches perfectly.
It really is magic.
Sally is saved, And we got there with one single line of math.
It is mathematically identical. 440 plus a negative 10 is the exact same thing as taking the 410 cash and adding the 20-cent futures game. The master formula is so powerful because it completely skips the entire step of calculating the futures profit. It forces you to just look at the anchor and the final local reality.
That is brilliant. It saves so much cognitive load on the test. You don't have to worry about, did my futures make money or lose money? You just plug in the basis. But I have to flag an exam trap right here.
Explain the trap.
This is exactly where the exam tries to get you if you try to do the math in your head using the two market method and you don't use the master formula. The trap is about the physical reality of the seller. The net selling price adds the futures gain to the cash sale.
Right.
The exam will give you this exact scenario. Cash sold at 410, futures generated a gain of 20. And I guarantee you one of the multiple choice options will just say 410.
Oh, absolutely.
The test writers are hoping you read the problem, see that she sold her cash crop for 410, and immediately click answer A because your brain says, well, that's what she sold it for. If you pick 410, you are completely ignoring the fact that she placed a hedge in the first place.
And it gets worse. Another multiple choice option will probably be 390 because they are hoping you get confused and accidentally subtract the 20-cent futures gain from the 410 cash price instead of adding it.
Yes. You have to visualize the physical action. Visualize Sally taking that 20-cent physical check from her futures broker and physically placing it on top of the stack of cash she got from the elevator. 410 plus 20 is 430, adding to her revenue.
So that perfectly illustrates the short hedge. That is the seller's reality. Now let's completely cross the universe and look at the exact opposite scenario. Let's look at cornflakes, Carl. Let's do processor math for a long hedge.
Let's do it. Picture Carl sweating in his glass office, overlooking the factory floor, terrified that the price of corn is going to go to the moon and he's going to have to shut down production.
Exactly. Carl needs to buy thousands of bushels of corn later this year to keep the factory running. He fears a massive price rise. To hedge against this, he initiates a long hedge by calling his broker right now and buying futures at 440.
Okay, so his initial futures price is 440. He has locked his anchor. He is long futures, short cash.
Time passes, the summer hits, and Carl's absolute worst nightmare comes true. There is a historic drought across the entire Midwest. The local physical cash price for corn at his Chicago supplier spikes all the way up to an agonizing 470 cents a bushel.
Oh, man.
And the global futures market has also rallied massively, rising to 465.
Okay, time for action. The factory needs grain today. Carl has to act. First, the physical world. He calls his supplier and is forced to buy physical corn to make the cereal, paying the exorbitant, painful cash price of 470.
Right.
Second, the paper world. Simultaneously, he calls his broker and closes his hedge by selling his futures position at 465.
Let's walk through the buyer's working form, the two market add up. In the physical cash market, Carl pays out 470. That is a massive, terrible expense leaving his bank account.
Right. But let's check his counterweight. Let's check his futures leg. He bought futures initially at 440. He just sold them to close the position at 465. Buy low, sell high. 465 minus 440 is a massive financial gain of 25 cents per bushel.
Correct. Now, here is the crucial counterintuitive rule for buyers that trips up so many people. A buyer subtracts a futures gain from their cash purchase price.
Wait, I'm going to push back on this because my brain is screaming right now. Subtract a gain. That sounds completely wrong. If I gain something, should my numbers go up? Why on earth am I subtracting a gain?
Think about what Carl is calculating. He is not calculating his revenue like Sally was. He is calculating his costs.
Right.
If you are calculating how much money you spent and someone hands you free money, your total out-of-pocket expenses go down. You subtract the free money from your total bill.
Okay. Let me use a real-world analogy to lock this in.
Yeah.
Let's say I go to the electronics store to buy a brand new TV, and the physical price tag on the TV is $470. That's my cash price. But I happen to have a $25 gift card in my pocket that my broker gave me.
Right.
When I get to the register, I hand them the $470 bill, but I also hand them the $25 gift card. My effective out-of-pocket net cost is $470 minus $25. It knocks money off my total cost.
That is the exact perfect analogy. A futures gain for a buyer acts like a gift card that reduces the effective purchase price. So let's run Carl's math. The net cost equals the 470 cash paid out minus the 25 cent futures gain gift card. Carl's effective net buying price is 445 cents per bushel.
445, which is significantly better than paying 470 naked in the cash market. The hedge absolutely saved him. His factory stays open. But as always, let's test our ultimate shortcut. Does the master formula work for buyers too? or do I have to remember a different rule?
It is the exact same formula. Run it. Initial futures price plus ending basis.
Step one, I have to find the ending basis. Cash minus futures at the exact time he lifts the hedge. The physical cash price was 470. The paper futures price was 465. 470 minus 465 is a positive 5, so the ending basis is positive 5 or 5 over.
Okay.
Step 2, plug it into the formula. Initial futures was 440, ending basis is a positive 5, 440 plus 5 is 445, it works again. Carl gets his cheat cornflakes at 445, and we didn't even have to calculate the futures gain or remember to subtract it.
It is absolutely airtight. The master formula works every single time for buyers and sellers, as long as you calculate the ending basis correctly as cash minus futures, and you keep the positive or negative sign mathematically intact.
I want to pause here and do a direct side-by-side comparison to really lock in the pattern for everyone listening. Because if you look closely, Soybean Sally and Cornflakes Carl are literal mirror images of each other.
They absolutely are. Let's compare their working forms side-by-side.
Sally is a seller. She is taking money in. When her counterweight generates a paper gain, she adds that futures gain to lift a terrible low physical cash price up. It raises her total revenue.
Right.
Carl's a buyer. He is paying money out. When his counterweight generates a paper gain, he subtracts the futures gain to pull a terrible high physical cash price down. It lowers his total cost.
It is the exact same iron counterweight concept, but applied in opposite mathematical directions based entirely on what they need to survive.
And pointing out those opposite mathematical directions leads us perfectly into our next major exam trap.
Oh, this is a big one.
This is where the exam tries to get you if you try to memorize the alternative working form. Instead of just trusting the master formula, mixing up the direction of the operation. If you accidentally add a futures gain when you were supposed to subtract it, you turn a brilliantly helpful hedge into absolute mathematical nonsense.
Right. Think about Carl. He physically paid 470 cash and he gained 25 on his futures trade. If you are rushing on the exam and you accidentally add them together, 470 plus 25 is 495. You just calculated that his hedge made his corn more expensive than if he had done nothing at all.
Which makes zero logical sense. Why would he go through all the trouble of hedging just to make his life worse? You have to anchor the mathematical sign to the physical reality. A seller adds a gain to boost their revenue. A buyer subtracts a gain to reduce their cost.
Exactly.
But honestly, this exact confusion is why the master formula is incredibly superior. Initial futures plus ending basis. If you just trust the master formula, you don't even have to worry about adding or subtracting futures gains. The underlying math just automatically handles the direction for you.
It forces you to rely on the basis, which, as we discussed, is the most fundamental physical concept in hedging anyway.
Okay, let's shift the energy a bit. Take a deep breath. We have clearly established that the ending basis is the final, ultimate piece of the puzzle. It is the tiny, localized adjustment stapled to the big initial futures price anchor. But what happens if that ending basis moves around wildly? Who wins and who loses when the basis changes?
This is one of the most fascinating dynamics in the commodity markets. It is the classic tug of war. Because basis affects buyers and sellers differently, and there is a universal law here that you must commit to memory. The two hedgers will always root for completely opposite basis moves, and that pairing never, ever flips.
Give me the rule of thumb.
A stronger ending basis raises the net price, which helps the seller. A weaker ending basis lowers the net price, which helps the buyer.
Okay, let's do the deep analysis on the why here. Why does a mathematically stronger basis automatically help the seller?
Think back to the sheer mechanics of our master formula. The formula is literally initial futures plus ending basis. It is a basic addition problem. If the ending basis goes up, if it gets mathematically stronger or more positive, the total mathematical output of that addition problem goes up.
Right. If my anchor is 100 and I'm adding 5, I get 105. If I'm adding 10, I get 110. A bigger number added makes the net result bigger.
Exactly. And a higher net number is fantastic if you are selling like Soybean Sally. She wants a high net price for her beans. But a higher net number is completely terrible if you are buying like Cornflakes Carl. He wants a low net price. Therefore, by sheer mathematical necessity, a stronger ending basis helps the seller and hurts the buyer.
I have a memory trick for this, because under the stress of the exam, it is incredibly easy to get tangled up in the logic of who wants what. Listen to the alliteration here. A strong basis is a strong result for the seller. All three start with the letter S. Strong, strong, seller.
That is a phenomenal mnemonic. Strong helps the seller. And by pure logical process of elimination, the exact inverse must be true. A weaker basis mathematically means a cheaper overall net price, which helps the buyer.
Okay, well, we have to sound the alarm right here because there's a massive gotcha on the exam regarding this concept. It involves the literal definition of the word stronger.
Yes. This trips up so many people. Stronger in commodity trading is a direction on a number line. It is not just a positive or negative sign.
Wait, explain that. I want to push back on this. Because if I hear the word strong, I immediately assume it means a positive number. Like positive 5 is strong and negative 5 is weak. Are you telling me that's wrong?
It is entirely wrong. And if you think that way, you will fail the question.
Oh, wow.
Stronger simply means moving upward on the number line, moving closer to positive territory, or becoming more positive. Let's use negative numbers. If a local basis moves from 10 under, which is mathematically negative 10, and it shifts to 5 under, which is mathematically negative 5, that basis just got stronger.
Yeah.
Whoa, stop. If a basis goes from negative 10 to negative 5, it gets stronger.
Yeah.
Even though it's still a negative number.
Absolutely. Think about a thermometer in the middle of winter. If it is negative 10 degrees outside on Monday, and it is negative 5 degrees outside on Tuesday, did it get warmer or colder?
It got warmer. Negative 5 is a higher temperature than negative 10.
Exactly. It moved up the thermometer. It moved up the number line. Negative 5 is mathematically larger or higher up the number line than negative 10. It went up. It strengthened. So even though the basis is still physically under, even though it is still technically a negative number, the fact that it moved in a stronger upward direction raises Soybean Sally's mathematical net selling price.
Okay, the thermometer analogy makes it click. Let's cement this with some rapid-fire detailed math examples. Mm-hmm. I want to prove this tug-of-war mathematically so no one ever forgets it. Let's start with Sally and her soybeans and show how a stronger negative basis helps her.
Let's do it. Sally initiates her short hedge by selling initial futures at 885. Based on historical data, she expects the local basis at harvest to be 10 under. Later in the year, she lifts the hedge with the physical cash market at 840 and the Chicago futures at 850.
Okay, let's pause and check the actual reality of the ending basis at the lift. Cash 840 minus futures 850 is negative 10. So the actual ending basis came in at 10 under exactly as she expected.
Right. So her net selling price, using our trusty master formula, is her initial futures of 885 plus a negative 10 ending basis. 885 plus negative 10 is 875. Her baseline net is 875.
Okay, direct question to you listening. Focus up. We just calculated her baseline net is 875 when the basis is 10 under. What if, at the time of the lift, the local elevator was suddenly desperate for beans and the basis came in stronger? Let's say it moved up the thermometer to 5 under. Does Sally make more money or less money? Think about the rule.
Take a beat to answer.
She makes more money. Let's do the math to prove it. Initial futures 885 plus the new stronger ending basis of negative 5. 885 plus negative 5 equals 880. Her net went from 875 to 880. She just made 5 cents more per bushel, pure profit, simply because the basis strengthened from negative 10 to negative 5. Strong basis, strong result for the seller.
Spot on. The math proves the rule perfectly. Now let's jump over to Chicago and look at Carl and his corn. He initiates his long hedge by buying initial futures at 425. He expects the basis to be 5 over. Later, he lifts the hedge with cash at 475 and futures at 470.
Let's check the ending basis. Cash 475 minus futures 470 is positive 5. So the ending basis is 5 over, just as he expected.
So his net buying price is his initial futures of 425 plus a positive 5 ending basis. His baseline net cost is 430.
Direct question time again. We know his baseline net cost is 430 when the basis is 5 over. What if the local cash market suddenly gets flooded with cheap grain and the basis comes in significantly weaker? Let's say it drops all the way down the thermometer to 5 under. Does Carl end up paying more out of pocket or less? Think about it.
Give it a second.
He pays LSS. Let's run the master formula to prove it. Initial futures, 425, plus the new, weaker ending basis of negative 5. 425 plus negative 5 equals 420. His effective net cost dropped from 430 down to 420, simply because the basis weakened. A weaker basis mathematically helps the buyer.
Those two examples prove the universal law perfectly. The master formula naturally accounts for the entire tug of war. If you plug in a stronger, higher basis, even if it's a smaller negative number, the final mathematical output goes up, helping the seller. If you plug in a weaker, lower basis, the final mathematical output goes down, helping the buyer.
It is just so deeply elegant when you see it work. It's like the map just clicks into place and perfectly represents physical reality. But as I say that, I feel like we are forgetting something. Nothing in life is free, right? Not even magic mathematical iron counterweights that save farmers and factory managers from catastrophic bankruptcy.
You are absolutely right to bring that up. Enter the reality of Wall Street. Enter the broker. We have to talk about the final piece of the puzzle, the commission toll booth.
Yes. Section 6, the toll booth. Because to get access to that magical counterweight, you have to use a futures exchange. And the broker, who actually executes those paper trades for you, wants to get paid for their service. They are not running a charity.
Exactly. The formulas we have been using up until this point, the master formula, the alternative working forms, those calculate what we call the gross net price. They are strictly the mathematical outcome of the markets before transaction costs. But actively trading the futures leg incurs a brokerage commission.
And how is that commission usually structured and charged in these exam problems?
It is almost universally charged as what we call a round turn.
Round turn, meaning it covers both halves of the transaction, entering the initial futures position in the spring and exiting it later in the fall when you lift the hedge. One fee for the whole ride.
Correct. It's usually quoted as a flat fee per contract or simplified on the exam as fractions of a cent per bushel.
Okay, so how does this toll booth actually affect our characters? Because a toll booth, fundamentally, is just money leaving your pocket and going to someone else.
That is exactly how you should think of it. It is a frictional cost borne entirely by the hedger, regardless of which side of the market they are on, and regardless of whether the futures trade itself was a massive winner or a devastating loser. The broker gets paid their round turn fee either way.
So let's look at Soybean Sally. She's a seller. Her entire goal is to receive money for her crop. If she has to pay a commission to her broker, that's just going to eat directly into her final profits.
Right. A commission mathematically lowers the short hedger's net selling price. If her gross net selling price was 875 cents and she owes a 1 cent per bushel round turn commission to her broker, her true final net cash in her pocket is 874. It trims the result.
Okay. And for cornflakes, Carl?
Yeah.
He's a buyer. He is bleeding money out to acquire corn. If he also has to pay a commission to his broker on top of everything else, that just adds insult to injury. It increases his total out-of-pocket expenses.
Exactly. A commission mathematically raises the long hedger's net buying price. If his gross net cost was 445 cents and he owes a 1 cent commission to the broker, his true total cost out the door is 446.
Okay, so the execution strategy here for the exam. How do we actually handle this practically when we are staring at a massive word problem with five different numbers, dates, and prices swirling around?
The strategy is to keep it incredibly, strictly simple. First rule, unless the question specifically hands you a commission figure and explicitly tells you to account for it, ignore it completely. Assume it is zero. Do not overcomplicate things if they don't specifically ask for it.
Good rule. Keep it clean, and if they do give it to you.
If they do give it to you, do not under any circumstances try to weave the commission into the math halfway through the problem. Do the entire initial futures plus ending basis calculation first, find that gross net price, treat the commission as the absolute final, very last step right before you pick your multiple choice answer.
Do the master math, get the baseline, and then physically hit the toll booth on your way out the door.
Exactly. Once you have the gross mathematical number, just stop and ask yourself, am I a seller like Sally or a buyer like Carl? If you're Sally, you subtract the commission because it eats your profit. If you're Carl, you add the commission because it inflates your costs.
Which brings us to the final place the exam tries to trick you, applying the commission mathematically backward.
The test writers know that under the extreme pressure of a timed exam, candidates get sloppy with basic addition and subtraction.
Right. They will give you Sally's scenario, where her gross selling price is $875 and there's a 1 cent commission. One of the multiple choice answers will correctly be $874 because paying the broker lowered her net profit. But I guarantee you another answer option will be $876.
They are desperately hoping you just see a number in the text and mechanically add it without thinking about the physical reality. But adding a commission to a seller's proceeds implies that the broker paid her to trade. It inflates the answer into total logical nonsense.
It's the exact same trap for Carl. If his gross cost is $445, the correct answer with a 1 cent commission is $446 because his costs went up. But they will offer $444 as a shiny option, hoping you subtract it because you associate commission with losing money. A commission always hurts you. It always makes your specific situation slightly worse.
Lower revenue for the seller, higher cost for the buyer. If you can simply remember that physical reality, the commission questions are basically free points on the exam.
All right, let's take a collective deep breath. Everyone stretch, sit up straight, roll your shoulders back. We are hitting the outro, which means it is time for the rapid fire recap. We have covered an absolute mountain of highly technical material, but we need to distill it down to the absolute top testable takeaways for your Series 3 exam. I'm going to throw the concepts out. You confirm the details.
I am ready.
Point one, the master formula, the holy grail of this entire deep dive. How do we calculate the net price without doing all the complicated math?
Net price always, always equals initial futures price plus the ending basis. And remember, it is the ending basis at the exact time the hedge is physically lifted, not the opening basis.
Point two. If we have to use the two market method, what is the net result of a hedge?
The net result is always the physical cash market result added to the financial futures market result. Never grade a hedge by looking at the futures leg alone. That is a guaranteed trap.
Point three, a psychological one. Is losing money on a futures leg a bad thing?
No. Losing money on the futures leg is totally perfectly normal in a working hedge. If the physical crash market moves wildly in your favor, the futures counterweight is mathematically supposed to lose money. It means the hedge is working as designed.
Point four. If you are forced to use the alternative working forms, what are the directional rules for the futures game?
Sellers ADD futures gains to their physical cash price to boost their revenue. Buyers subtract futures gains from their physical cash cost to cheapen their purchase.
Point five. The tug of war. The rule of S.
A strong basis is a strong result for the seller. And the logical inverse is true. A weaker basis mathematically helps the buyer.
Point six, the toll booth. How do we handle commissions?
Commissions always hurt you. They are a frictional cost. Do them absolutely last. Subtract them from a seller's final net revenue and add them to a buyer's final total cost.
That is the core of hedging calculations. If you have those 6 points memorized, and more importantly, if you intuitively understand the why behind them, you are going to absolutely destroy this section of the exam.
I completely agree. The underlying arithmetic is just basic addition and subtraction. It is the physical mechanics of the real world that you have to lock in.
Before we sign off, I want to hand it over to you for one final thought, because throughout this entire discussion, you've hinted at a much larger philosophical reality about what hedging actually accomplishes in the world.
Yes. We spent this whole deep dive talking about formulas and learning that a hedge swaps massive, terrifying flat price risk for tiny, manageable basis risk. That is the math. But I want you to think about what that really means for the physical world. It means that when Soybean Sally in Iowa or Cornflakes Carl in Chicago puts on a hedge, they are effectively isolating themselves from the chaos of the world. They are ultimately placing their financial survival not on the chaotic, unpredictable global price of grain traded by algorithms on screens in New York or London, but entirely on their own local reality.
That is such a powerful way to frame it. The global geopolitical risk is completely neutralized.
Exactly. Because the only floating variable left in their mathematical equation is the local ending basis. And what determines the local ending basis, it is pure local physical supply and demand. It is whether there are enough train cars at the specific depot in their county that week. It is whether the local trucking route is flooded from a storm. It is the micro weather in a 3-county radius. When you sit down and do these hedging calculations on the exam, you aren't just doing abstract, boring finance math. You are literally quantifying the local physical reality of commodities. You are stripping away all the global noise to reveal the local truth. That is what hedging actually is.
I love that. Stripping away the global noise to reveal the local truth. It makes the math feel so much more important. All right. That is our deep dive on hedging calculations. Keep running those master formulas. Visualize the counterweight. Don't let the exam traps get you, and go ace that test. We'll catch you on the next one.